Hello, welcome to another edition of Unplugged, reflecting on a fine victory last Thursday night. Feels a little while ago now as we get more of a conventional break. We build up towards Essendon, so the old foes continue. It's been an eventful week, reminiscent of the 2020 elimination final where you have a great win but lose three soldiers and left sort of reeling a little bit the next day, thinking, how do we cover that? And always comes with a, I don't know what the opposite of a silver lining is, but that seems to be the way of it of recent times. Opening up by saying valet to Andrew Plimpton, one of our favourite guests on this show and a great servant of the club, passionate saint, was a president during a highly eventful period for St Kilda during financial troubles, a grand final, Tony Lockett's departure, coaching sackings, home ground movements and the like, and guided St Kilda through those troubled waters very, very nicely. And it is very sad to hear of his passing during the week. And I might start there, Nick, as we welcome you. A tremendous win over Collingwood on a Thursday night. I mean, 70,000 at the MCG. It doesn't get much better than that in a home and away sense, and it really gets us rolling. And I guess, unfortunately, though, we've been paying tribute to the dearly departed far too frequently over the last couple of years. It seems like it's, you know, Morrow, Neil, Bonnie, the list goes on, sadly.
There's been a few, hasn't there? It's you know, a lot of these guys that have meant so much to the footy club, you know, are getting to that age now, unfortunately. And so it's time that we get that second one in the cabinet, so that, you know, a few of the older guys who are still around can see that. Going back to the footy, great night on Thursday night. I mean, it was a really interesting game because being there at the ground, it felt like really scrappy. I mean, it was turnover central for the first half. I think 8 minutes into the first quarter, the turnover count was like 12 to 15. It was something ridiculous. It was super ugly to watch. It was hard. Pressure was obviously very high, but it did feel like both teams made a lot of mistakes. Both teams kept each other in it at different parts, and you know, each team would get a period of momentum and kick a few in a row, and then they'd make a couple of big mistakes and let the other team in, and we certainly did that. Collingwood did it a couple of times. But it was funny watching the game back on replay that it was actually a much more enjoyable game to watch. It was a much better game of footy to watch on TV than it was at the ground. Mm. And I think that, you know, I think we were clearly the better team for the majority of the game, but we did keep opening the door for them and letting them in. And we know that even when they're not playing, you know, amazingly good football, that they're still tough to beat. You know, they're hard, they're contested. They make you win the ball and they make you earn it and all those sorts of things. And they did, they were obviously a little bit off. But, you know, we kept at it. And I think that was the most pleasing thing is, yeah, our contested ball, our attack on the contest, attack at the man, attack at the ball, was all really, really strong. And you know, we turned up, and ultimately, that's all you can ask of a young group. And this is a really, really young group. I think a lot of people can forget that sometimes, but this is a really young group, and they turned up prepared and ready to play, and they played their game. You know, we played the game on our terms. Yes, it didn't go our way all night, but we played the game on our terms. We were proactive. We made things happen ourselves, and got the chocolates at the end.
Yeah, H, I thought we, as Nick said, we were definitely the better side. We had periods of momentum. We lost our way for probably 15 minutes in the second quarter, and then obviously they got that little flurry midway through the last when we made a couple of mistakes, and it seemed to be a mistake that would spark that. It wasn't necessarily anything else where they just get a bit of a run on after we lost momentum for a second, you know, not putting that on Riley Bonner, for example, but there's a couple that stood out of second quarter and last quarter. Collingwood obviously made some glaring mistakes as well. But, yeah, on the most part, it felt like we controlled the game. And halfway through the last quarter, it looked like we'd win by 8 or 9 goals. So, overall, I think hard to find anybody that played a bad game.
Yeah, it was very much a game of momentum. They go out, what, 3-1? We kick 5. They kick 4 in a row. We kick 4. They kicked, I think they got 1 in, then we kicked another 3, and they kicked another 3. It was a very, very much a momentum night. Patches where one team would take it, and then the other would come back, or but yeah, you're talking about the clangers and that sort of thing on the night. And yeah, I had a look earlier and Collingwood on the night 78. But as you say, you look back at the game and you sort of go, it didn't feel like there was that many when you watch it on TV. It didn't like it didn't feel that bad. But the game itself, I just think made it look a lot better than what it really was, because it was tight, it was high pressure, it was a fast game at times. It was the ball actually pinged around quite a bit at times, and that's what I guess when you look back at some of the decisions they made at times, that pressure made them make some of those mistakes. How often have you seen their defense punch a ball straight down the throat of an opposition forward in front of goal? Their captain handballs the ball from the back, the goal square, straight to our player. Just mistakes that you sort of go, you don't see them make those mistakes that often. It's a situation where you go, it's great that we took the advantage in those situations, because a lot of time we probably would have stuffed it up ourselves, giving it straight back to them or whatever. But we made the most of those opportunities that they gave us. And made them pay, and that's how we beat them on the night, by pressuring them, and then making the most of the opportunities they gave us. I think it was the first seven goals or something we kicked were from turnovers or something like that, or
the seven that they kicked, that was seven from seven.
So
from
we
turnovers.
Pretty much we gave them.
Yep.
That, and I was trying to remember I saw something along the lines of we had a similar amount, might have been the next sort of batch that in our goal kicking for the night. But yeah, the pressure certainly made or created goals on the night, and that's what obviously hid that whole thing of where the mistakes really were.
Yeah, I mean, for a game like that, I mean, as you say, there were five huge clangers, three from them and two from us. Obviously, Frampton pile driving Higgins over the line in the first quarter, complete brain explosion. And then obviously Bonner with the little chip kick back into the corridor in the second quarter, and then playing on and getting the kick smothered in the last. You remember the glaring turnovers, which were obviously the three from them and the two from us. But yeah, the standard was very good. Our transition was excellent. I thought Collingwood, clearly they were off a bit, but they looked a bit more like themselves than they had in the first 2 weeks in terms of their setup and structure and their ball movement and their ability to at times squeeze us. So I thought they were a bit better. So therefore, the win is more pleasing for being able to handle that, and also the way we dealt with challenges. I think at halftime we'd given up four in a row to then come out and grab the game again. And then by the end of the third quarter, we were strangling them. It was really, really pleasing. I mean, look, last year we were nice and competitive against them. And I think, it probably demonstrates how strong our system is. And this week we have to find that out again, which we'll talk about later, because we're going to have to try to find a way to muscle a victory on system. Obviously losing the pace of Liam Henry and losing Max King, obviously at the time of recording, unsuccessful in his appeal at the tribunal. So that's all that stuff that we'll have to throw up and deal with. But I think also, Nick, it was pleasing for the first time. It's the fourth year we've had the Spuds game. It's the first time we've actually played well. So I think that's worth acknowledging, that we came to the party on that occasion for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, big night, primetime game, standalone game on a Thursday night at the MCG under lights, event game, milestone game, Seb Ross and his 200th. I mean, all these things that we historically have not been very good at. So to do that on the occasion and given the emotion and all those sorts of things was really pleasing. And I think should give this group a lot of confidence moving forward. I mean, I think regardless of whether Collingwood are playing their best footy or not, I think, they're still better than Essendon. And they should go into next week with no fear, thinking that no matter who's in or out, that there's guys that can cover and guys that can come in and next man up and all those things, because we trust in each other, we trust in ourselves, and the coaches trust in the players to execute a game plan, which they've done. successfully against a really good team on their home patch, even though it was our home game. But, you know, big crowd under the lights at the G, and we did the job.
And look, last year, you know, we without Max King for an extended period, we didn't know how long that was going to be, and we were able to put a system together. This is one game effectively where you almost, even if you reinvent the wheel for 1 week and find a way and see what happens. You know, we'll talk about who comes in. It seems the changes are probably obvious given the amount of soldiers going down in terms of what we have. The Mason Wood one, for those who are at the ground versus those watching it on TV, look, it would have been frightening regardless of the situation. But watching it on television, obviously when you see a player convulsing in that situation and you see that they've landed not just on their head but on their neck, you have obviously all sorts of worries around that. And, you know, the emotions of a St Kilda supporter where you're sitting there going, oh, thankfully he's moving around and it's just a concussion. It's like, oh, no, wait, it's not. It's a broken collarbone, so he's going to miss more weeks. But it was horrible to watch, and I don't know what the perception was at the ground. But, yeah, it certainly put a bit of a hush over things.
Yeah, I was only a few rows back where it pretty much happened right in front of me. And, like, first it was the sound, the two hitting each other. It was a clear just smack between the two players. They hit pretty hard. The fact Cordy got up, you sort of go, he was probably pretty lucky. He's obviously got him, well, if you say it, the better, in the collision. It's, yeah, they hit very hard, and pretty much I was watching that from the time it happened to, I was pretty much looking up at the ball occasionally to see where the ball was, because I was just watching to see what was happening. And yeah, he was not well from the moment he was on the ground, and you saw him just going, like, as you're saying, convulsing. And the first trainers, a few trainers got there, were basically signaling, saying, yeah, come on, we need this out here quick. But there was, I guess, with a few people looking, sort of looking, going, yeah, there could be some serious damage here at first, because the time and how long it took him to sort of move him in the first instance. So I guess lucky he was probably on his side to begin with, which was a good thing. But just the time between him being on the ground to the first time they sort of rolled him over onto his back to move him, that it was a fair time and gap there. Obviously the cart took its time to get out there as well. That was the other thing. It was I remember it was close to 8-9 minutes, I think, stoppage. A lot of care taken to get him off the field, which is what you obviously want to see. But yeah, it was pretty scary at first. You think, yeah, that did not look good at all. And yeah, I guess if he comes out of it, he's got the broken collarbone, which is what, a 6 week, eight week injury. He would have missed probably a couple of weeks with how heavy the concussion was anyway. But yeah, just maybe gets himself right and yeah, be back by, as I was saying, about round 9-10, depending on how well he goes. And yeah, hopefully it's a speedy recovery.
Yeah, it looks like best case scenario is potentially even a month. It says 4 to 6 weeks. So, I mean, we don't get best case scenario very often, but it'd be nice if we could land that. I mean, Liam Henry went from a cramp to half a season, so which sort of the way it seems to go sometimes. We'll put a bow around that with our votes and our awards. We'll be joined by Glenn Elliott, star midfielder for the Saints through the 70s. A little bit later on, best and fairest winner, Simpson medalist for Victoria as well. But all of our votes are pretty similar, which is not surprising, but a very even game. So there would have been a few names that popped up. Reading my own votes again, I realised I left Josh Battle out, which is a significant apology, but gave one vote to Liam Henry, gave us good pace. Mitch Owens was excellent in a number of roles. Jack Higgins, you know, you get the good and the bad with Jack. I thought he was poor the week before, and then you get the match-winning Jack, and I guess that's part and parcel of it. Rowan Marshall, very good, controlled the airways again. Jack Steele, second week in a row, was our best One of our best midfielders. He was probably shaded by Marcus Windhager in the number two this week, who gets the two votes. He was brilliant. That's easily the best game he's played, and the highlights packages look spectacular. Mm. And then for the second week in a row, I thought Isaiah Wanganeen-Miller, a BOG, gets the three votes. But, Nick, how did you assess it?
Very similar. I mean, it was a very even performance. I don't think anyone really played a bad game. I mean, you look at some of the bigger name players, and generally, you know, they kind of stood up. You know, Membry kicked multiple goals. Jack Sinclair coming back was probably a little rusty, but you imagine he'll be better for the run. I think he still led everyone for ground covered over the course of the night. I think he was the number one running player for the night. Ryan Burns was very good and probably just missed a vote for mine. But I gave one to Max King. I think he looks fitter, stronger, dangerous. It's a real shame that he's going to miss this week, because felt like he was coming into some consistency through the last period of the preseason. Played pretty well in Geelong, played really well again on Thursday night. So it's a shame that he's going to miss one, but yeah, maybe a guy like him, maybe a week off every now and then is going to do him some good. But he looks fit and strong and healthy and happy and in form. One vote to Josh Battle, who I thought was our best defender. I know Cal Wilkie was also pretty good, but I think Battle did more, I think, coming back the other way as well. Vote to Higgins, who just has the ability to turn a game really quickly. Like you said, Darren, can go missing for large portions. Yeah, often for games at a time, let alone for quarters at a time. But when he's on and very, very good. Rowan Marshall, as you said, really strong at the contest and helped us dominate at ground level. Yeah, I think he lost the hitouts by a large margin. I think at one stage, yeah, at quarter time, I think it was one hit out to 13 Collingwood's way. And his one hit out came in the last 15 seconds of that first quarter. His ability to win the ball, win a clearance, I think he had 11 or 12 clearances. His stoppage work is phenomenal. He was excellent. Jack Steele, I thought, another good game, and good to see him stringing some good footy together. Marcus Windhager looks fantastic. Super confident, understands his size and his strength and his power and running ability now, which it felt like he hasn't always done that since he came into the league. But he looks super strong and super confident and really, you know, getting better almost weekly at the moment, and just looks like a super player. And Isaiah Wanganeen-Miller was just superb again. And I'm going to maybe have a little take on Naz a little bit later on. But, I mean, he's just an incredible player. Should be well and truly, you know, top of our best and fairest, I think, at this early stage of the season. And, you know, the way he's playing, you could quite easily see him winning a Brownlow, to be honest.
Yeah, at the moment, for sure. And H, keen to get your votes as well. And on Marshall, I think he had the first four clearances of the game, even though he wasn't winning hitouts. So it says a little bit, but your votes, H?
Yeah, so we start with one for Lee Fisher.
first time ever he's looked after us.
They took instruction from Ross Lyon really well, apparently, according to
the fans. It was out for us all night, it sounds like. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think he gave us that many compared to the others. When I look back at it, it was quite interesting.
And doesn't usually.
So. No, we usually don't get any from him at all.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it was the main takeaway from the very much educated Collingwood fans all around us. So, so as Nick was saying, Josh Battle, I reckon he was the best defender of night as well. Just popped up where he could. I partly filled the role Mason Wood played a little bit last week when you looked at it. Mm. He was the one that was trying to, I guess, get back and jump in that hole and just caused a bit of chaos when they were trying to enter the 50 and just got there where he was needed. One to Steele in the middle, great. Again, Mitch Owen, same thing. As I said, he's playing well. I just don't think he's there yet. We could just almost see him just exploding at some point. He's doing a lot, but there's signs that he could just take off all of a sudden. I think we're all waiting for that to happen. Go to Jack Higgins. Wasn't just the goals he kicked. his work on the ball, around the ground, when we didn't have it, the pressure in the forward line, it was all there that week, last week. He played a fantastic game. He was absolutely everywhere. So, yeah, hopefully we can see that sort of performance more often than not from now on. As there, he's struggled other weeks, but hopefully those sort of performances, yes, come along a lot more often than what they have. 2 to Windager, just massive in the middle, massive. And that picture of him with Dacos on his backpack after the game was fantastic. And yeah, 3 to Naz, he's flying, and yeah, I mean, hopefully Mitchy jumps up to, as we're saying, that same sort of level as Naz is at, and those two will take the competition by storm.
Yeah, if we end up with 4, I mean, obviously Filippo did a couple of nice things. Not many guys kick left foot snap goals from outside 50, but having Owens, Wanganeen, Miller, Windhager and Filippo, if you end up with 4 elite kits, obviously you're tracking along pretty well. And yeah, Wilson, 3 of those guys coming in one draft is a huge bonus for what we're able to do. Take Nass first and then get Windhager and Owens as academy prospects could be a goldmine for us.
Darcy Wilson feels like a steal as well.
Yeah, he does, and shortening a bit in rising star markets as well. In what is a pretty even race. The Jason Blake Award, I stole a bit of thunder on this one last week, so Nick, do you want to go first to avoid that?
Well, I alluded to it a little bit earlier talking about Naz, and I wanted to give Naz this award this week. I know he's getting a lot of plaudits. I think he's getting a lot of credit. He's playing unbelievable footy. But I think, you know, we all talk about his kicking ability and his disposals and the way that he moves, but I think we probably don't appreciate as much the effort part of his game, the ground he covers, his ability to make up space and fill space in the middle when the ball's there to be won in a contest. His contest work is actually very strong for a guy his size, and his ability to put body on to attack the ball, but also the way that he reads it across half back and often, you know, popping up for 2 or 3 intercept marks a game, floating across the front of packs. I think that his ability goes beyond just his disposal skill and execution, but it's actually the way that he understands the game and attacks the game. And I feel like he's just got it figured out. And as well as his playing, as much credit as he's getting, I think that we probably underestimate and underappreciate what he's doing at the moment as well. So Jason Blake Award for Naz this week.
Good shout. H?
I've got to give it for someone who was, I guess, underrated before the game and after the game. He had to put up with a 50 game, have been given the much higher plaudits before the game started and half time as well, apparently. And even after the game, it seemed like it just continued on. But yeah, Seb Ross, 200th game. He played a great game on one of the dozen players I probably should have given an apology to for not giving a vote. He turned up, he provided this really well in the middle. But I mean, you play 200 games, you basically don't get a word in anywhere. And yeah, he probably hasn't been given the plaudits that he deserved this week. And yeah, for a 200th game, it was, yeah, couldn't ask much more of him. So yeah.
Agree entirely. He's been a fine player for us, multiple best and fairest winner. He captained the club for long periods of time when Geary was injured. Yeah, he's been terrific. I know he's had his critics and can understand some of that around ball use, but a very, very good player for our club, Seb Ross, and former guest on this pod as well. But going to give a nom to the sub, Zach Jones. You don't expect the sub to come on halfway through the first quarter. And I thought Zach gave us a lot of link-up work, although he ran to some dangerous positions. He got a fair bit of the ball. He made some good decisions and was a really good part of the chain. So I think he should get better from there, but I think he did a really good job and we really needed him to do that given the circumstances. It's probably a bit harder, H, on the old Shannon Knoll this week, but were you able to scrounge out anything?
Well, if anyone needs the lift, it's our medical team.
Yeah.
Let's get all these guys back. Let's get them back as soon as we can. That's all we ask. Just get as many of them back as we can. 100% fit. Soon as possible. I don't think we could ask much more.
Yeah, I think that the closest to returning are Paddy Dow and Jack Hayes. Obviously, Butler will play this week, you'd think. So, but everyone seems to be a month or more. But, Nick, have you got one for us?
Collingwood fans. Yeah. They won a flag 6 months ago, and they're out here crying and whinging because they didn't get a couple of free kicks once. Like, they've had the rub of the green and been kissed on the dick by the umpires for 150 years. And, you know, the one time it goes against them, they whinge and bitch and moan forever on every platform, in person. H, you and I at the cricketers after the game, and those Collingwood fans crying salty, salty tears about having to lose a game to St Kilda and, you know, chanting about 2010 and all these other things. It's like, dude, you won a grand final 6 months ago. Like, what are you complaining about? Like, enjoy it. Just enjoy it.
Yeah, anyway. I don't get the mindset. They're a different breed. It's quite incredible. Some of the commentary, even, you know, the criticism of their own side and stuff like that. I mean, yeah, 3 games ago. And, I mean, umpiring didn't make Darcy Moore handball to Brad Hill at the top of the goal square for no apparent reason. And the amount of other, you know, they didn't allow Nash to run unchecked off halfback and get 30 touches and...
Oh, and that Frampton one is just one of the dumbest things I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, and the first goal of the game hit the ground.
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly.
I don't know what anyway. Mine would probably be, he's been good, and I thought he was still good on Friday, Thursday night despite the errors. But, I guess with Riley Bonner, just decision-making, I guess. Some mistakes you get away with, some you don't. He didn't for those two, and I thought Ross handled it very well, saying, you know, game's 100 minutes, he had a bad 2 minutes, the rest was good, and that's true, but just that decision making and things like that. He's obviously got a third chance at AFL level, or second chance at AFL level rather, and really significant for him to just make sure that he, you know, chooses those options wisely, I think, and otherwise doing a pretty good job. We'd run through the injury list, but that would be a segment in its own right. We'll touch on the clash with Essendon shortly, but we are to be joined by our latest special guest this week. Played 139 games for the club. It is Glenn Elliott. Well, Glenn Elliott was a star for the Saints through the 1970s. A few numbers that will tap that off. Obviously, the obvious ones, 138 games from the club between 1969 and 1977. Played in the 71 grand final, best and fairest in 74. Won the Simpson Medal representing Victoria against WA in 1976, but a few others as well. Throughout the 1970s, Glenn Elliott had 30 possessions in a game or more on 22 occasions. Only one St Kilda player did it 10 times. Other than that, it was Paul Callery, who's been a guest on our program, and he also had 6 of St Kilda's top 10 possession games through that decade. It was a very fine player, and we're delighted to have him as a part of our podcast this week. Glenn, thanks for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for making contact.
Now, you did mention off air before we started that you were kind of a bridge between eras, that you played with a lot of the premiership heroes of 66, and then it obviously went a little bit tricky for St Kilda through the 70s, but we had a few chances, you know, obviously 71 when you played in the grand final, 72, 73 with finals, but interesting part of St Kilda's history, I imagine, to be a part of, a very good side for a period there, and maybe could have won another flag.
Oh, yes, we were just talking about the different era and about my parents agreeing for me to go to St Kilda when I'd been a long-term Collingwood fan, and quite mystified once I'd got there that there was a dual Brownlow medalist who played in the centre. And my first year there was a bit challenging because just leaving school after all those years, I probably didn't handle it as well as some.
Well, I mean, taking a step back, how did you end up at St Kilda? I mean, you from Yay, I think you went to Scotch College and played some footy at Scotch. How did you end up at Moorabbin?
I came from Yay in the northeast. I went to Scotch at boarding school, and a couple of clubs, zoning was in at that stage, and the Yay area was zoned to Geelong, and I was probably destined to go to Geelong, and I'm not sure to my own memory as to how it all came about, but my parents ended up meeting with St Kilda, and I think they ended up doing a transfer a couple of days before zoning actually came into place. So if it had just taken its normal course of events, I'd have been zoned to Geelong.
So first senior game was actually a win against Hawthorn. Recollection of that day, how it went, how you were before the game, who you lined up on, that sort of thing?
Oh, probably can't remember my opponent, but certainly I think I played in half forward flank from memory. So I think we won the game from memory. But yes, I think you'll probably hit me with some stats, but I don't think it would have been outrageously generous in terms of what I achieved on the day.
22.
Not a bad day. Touches. Not bad for a senior debut. 22 touches.
Well, he's an incredible coach at that stage too, Alan Jeans, and obviously he'd been to St Kilda and was later to be at Hawthorn, and I can vividly remember my first year there and training with Jeansy, and went and put my arm around him one night when we were walking off and said, "Look, I'm getting a few kicks in the twos. Is there any help? Can you give me a bit of help about what I've got to do to get a senior game?" And he loosely put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "You'll find it's easier to do what I want you to do." And I said, "Does that mean listen?" And he said, "That'll help." And it took an eternity for most of us who played with Jeansy to earn his respect. But once you'd earned it, it was a lifelong commitment, which was very gratifying and probably a hard lesson to learn, actually.
Back then, it was often very positional, where one person would have a spot, you'd be playing for that spot. I mean, these days they run players off the bench and you have nine midfielders and that type of thing. But how much did you learn from having Stewie there in the early days when the time did come that you were the prime centreman for the remainder of your career? How influential? I know it probably held you back from playing in that position for a little while, but when you got that chance, how big had he been for you?
He was quite a mate, actually, and he tended to stay out late at night as well, which probably helped me get to know him. But look, it was interesting. I can remember playing against him when he went to Richmond, and always remember his remarks at the opening bounce. He said, "You know, you'd never got a senior game unless I'd left," and which was a welcome to the MCG. But halfway through the third quarter, when Jeansy's instruction that day was to simply, I wasn't measured by how many kicks I got, I was measured by how many kicks my opponent got. And I said to Stewie halfway during the third quarter, "Have you ever had so few kicks by just after three quarter time?" And I won't tell you what its response was. we'd probably have to cut the chat a little bit short. You're interested when you made that comment about the transformation of footy, or the, if you'd call it that. I knew my opponents for the year. It was virtually Bedford and then Price at Collingwood, who was too fast for me, and a whole range of other players whom you knew, or Thorpe out of Footscray. You knew your opponents before you even started the year. It's all changed.
What's your recollection of that period with the Stewart Barrett transfer, and like what was it talked about at the club within amongst teammates and your friends? Was it talked about then?
It may have been talked about by Stewie was probably somebody that I nearly idolised as a person who knew a little bit about VFL footy, but it may have been talked about more amongst the senior players. To me, it was a celebration when he left. so when Barrett came, he was never popular. Well, very few people would remember it now, but that era, there was player transfers were a bit uncommon because Barrett came there and Rex Hunt came there for a couple of years at one stage, and was probably the noisiest man in the change room we've ever heard. A bit quiet out the race, but he entertained people when he was inside.
But, not much has changed.
We had I think St Kilda might have led the way in the introduction of the WA people to the VFL back then, when McIntosh turned up, and then George Young, who was just an outstanding, and Bruce Duperreuzel. So there were some great players came from WA to St Kilda at that time.
Just before you move on, one more question about that before you get back to your career. But your memories of Billy Barrett and his 1.5 games for St Kilda?
Quite relieved that he didn't make it. Say that. He's probably a nice fellow. I never got to know him. And, he had a very short stint at St Kilda. But I was literally in real terms, I was relatively a junior because I was, 18 or 19. And so it was a different era. And you, at that stage, you probably socialised more with your own age group. So you weren't privy to a lot of things that were happening at senior level.
Did you find the pressure at that age stepping into pretty much the boots of a Hall of Fame centreman to step up into what he was doing? How did you, handle that? Or did you just think, well, I'm just going to play my game and stepped into there?
I think, I had different attributes to Stewie. Stewie's a highly skilled dual-sided player, and I probably prayed for the rain a bit because for all intents and purposes I was a bit slow. And at one stage probably nearly left St Kilda before I'd started when there was an approach from Geelong to go down there because Rod Olsen had been tied up with Scotch over the years and he was coaching down at Geelong. But I was to be there and to earn Alan Jean's respect, I probably ended up with a career because I did what I was told. And then as you became a more automatic selection, I think Jeansy gave you a little bit more latitude and a little bit more latitude. And we had some great fitness coaches at the time. So I was never destined to win a sprint race. So I probably took the option of trying to be the building a highest level of sustainability as opposed to the fastest. And that probably helped me over the journey.
A philosophy that worked well for someone like Robert Harvey a couple of generations later was very similar in that space, just became the running machine. 1971, the word tragedy gets thrown around a lot unnecessarily, but that was a St Kilda tragedy, that grand final, 28 points in front just before three-quarter time. Yeah. Recollections of that day, Hawthorn were an unbelievable side. We've heard about the Cowboy, Peter Hudson saga, but yep. Your recollections of that near miss?
Probably Keddie. What did he get? 3 in the last quarter, didn't he, I think, from memory?
4, yeah.
So I know you probably chatted to Cat, Gary Colling, and probably not the most memorable experience he'd have. A couple of us have jokingly blamed him for not having a premiership medal around our to be able to display people, but that's a little bit harsh. And we did enough to win, but both sides were highly competitive, probably played a similar brand of football to each other as well. But it was, having only been there for a couple of years, 71, you thought, well, this is upwards and onwards forever. It was seemingly a little bit too good to be true, but I think my most vivid memory was the sadness at the end of the game, and you're oblivious to the fact that there was anybody at the MCG, as I mentioned before, and to think that there were so many people there still seeing the end of it, and yet you were there and couldn't hear anybody. It was a lifelong memory.
Tell us about one of the stars of that team in Cowboy Neil, who obviously had played a big role in the 66 premiership a few years earlier, but yep. Played a pretty big part in that 71 grand final as well. What are your memories of Cowboy?
Cowboy is the most welcoming person you could ever meet in a football club. And I think that for somebody who's new at the club, whether you're a first-year player or whether you're a 10-year player, he smiled at everybody. And he welcomed everybody with his face. And I think it's, I can remember, going to a couple of over at Wodonga there, the get-togethers for him, and he still had a smile on his face even then. And I'm not 100% sure whether he would have recognised some of us, but I think that's where he was so consistent, and he brought the club sort of built around that person because he didn't treat you as a second player or a senior player. He treated you as a person, which was priceless. And if anyone had a bad look on their face, he'd always had a joke to tell as well. But so he was, just a marvelous individual to be involved with. And his efforts against Hudson, well, they're memorable. And it is interesting, isn't it, that a fellow could kick those goals as full forward and then end up fullback in the next grand final that the club played in. But yes, he would have extended every rule known to the football fraternity then, I would have think, in stopping Hudson. And if they'd had maybe a camera just on Hudson and Cowboy for the day, it would have been interesting watching.
So moving forward just a little bit, you pick up Best and Fairest in 1974. You see these big events these days for Best and Fairest and everything. There's like a huge night sort of thing. Take us back to 1974 and how it happened and what did the club do back then?
We went to the Moorabbin Town Hall. it was announced and it wasn't forewarned, and probably I was a little bit surprised by it, but yes, there certainly wasn't any live count. It was more an announcement of the various award winners and things like that, and it probably came as a bit of a shock you don't anticipate having a season strong enough to win a club, what do they call it? Best and Fairest, where we were back then, I think, not club champion. But, I remember the night, and probably there was no big celebration after it. I think we just went home. you weren't in on the Yarra there, sort of going to some flash casino or whatever. It was it's very humble, the facilities down at Moorabbin.
So obviously St Kilda had made finals 70, 71, 72, 73, slipped a bit after that, but 75 and 76, Jeansy's last 2 years were very competitive, probably should have made the finals in 75. Do you have any, I guess, recollections of that side? It didn't fall off a cliff. Obviously through the mid-70s we were still pretty competitive.
Oh, I think we're around the mark. I mean, Alan Jeans was always, somebody – I think jokingly said at one stage he'd probably get more pride out of a courageous narrow loss than a spectacular victory. But that's a bit harsh on Jeansy's coaching, because it changed a lot when he went to Hawthorn. And he did the best with what he had. And I think making sure that the club was competitive was his great forte. And to a degree, I suppose Ross Lyons brings a bit of that to St Kilda today. In the sense that, they're highly competitive all over the field. And I think that was Jeansy's number one. It didn't matter what position you were playing in. Being competitive was the most, the quality he was looking for most in people. And particularly he'd, as I jokingly said before, he had great confidence in those who'd earned his respect, or those who'd listened to him for long enough and did what they were told.
I guess before the end of your time at St Kilda, had a bad knee injury. Do you remember how that happened, how you did the knee? And then what was, I guess, the next 18 months like in terms of your recovery and rehab until you finally came back to senior footy with Melbourne?
It was horrendous. And, yes, I can remember being carried off and seeing Owen Deakin, the club specialist at the time, and we were all frightened to see him because normally meant you ended up with plaster of some description. But, it really became quite difficult, and I probably reached the end of my tether, actually, in terms of having to turn up to the club and be seen, and people asking how your leg was when you knew it wasn't any good at all. And, it was a strange transition to go across to Melbourne, because I can't remember St Kilda actually asking me to play again, despite the fact I was running around Moorabbin Oval doing a lot of my training. And I had a call from Melbourne, and they asked me how I was recovering. I said, oh, not too bad. And would I be interested in catching up with him? And I said, no, I think it'll be fine here. And I'll leave the person's name out of it, but the person at Melbourne suggested that wouldn't be the case, that it might be better if you were open to seeing us. And because Carl Dietrich was there at the time, and that probably had some influence in it, I would say. But yes, going to Melbourne was interesting. After I went there nervously, to be perfectly frank, because I wasn't sure whether I'd be able to play again. I had a practice match at Paran Oval, and somehow or other got through that and did very little training in the lead up to that. But I think it was the fact that I had a good relationship with Carl Dietrich, which probably allowed me to get an opportunity to play again. And from St Kilda's point of view, you may or may not remember that late 70s, the club wasn't exactly a financial powerhouse. And so there were a lot of players that were disappointed at the time in the way things the way they played out. So I've got to say quite brutally, I wasn't there sitting there looking to try and find another club to play at. It just happened. And it was interesting that the physio who was the physio at St Kilda, he'd gone back to Melbourne, and I had to see him for my fitness test. And so when they sent me out to see him, he put his arm around my shoulder and said, "What am I seeing you about?" And I said, "You've got a rough idea." And he pushed and prodded my knee for a little while and said, "It's not very good, is it?" And I said, "No," but or he told Ray Manley that. And then Ray called me the next day and said, "Could you come in and sign your contract?" And so I did, and saw him. And when I saw Ray, I said, it was Adrian Wright, the physio. And I said, "What did Adrian say about my knee?" He said, "It's stuffed, but you'll play anyway." Not exactly. I don't think that would pass the test today, would it?
Probably not.
Say definitely not. But there was there was a joy in going to the MCG when you used to get there, apart from finals, once or twice a year, to be able – the Melbourne players, many of them would have understated the experience that they had to just go out and have kick-to-kick on the MCG two or three times a week when with nobody in the stands was quite unique, and what a fabulous stadium it is.
So – after finishing up at Melbourne, you've kept in the football game in different ways, mainly in South Australia. Run us through where you've been after that, who you've been with, which teams and that sort of thing.
Yeah, came to South Australia with work after I'd been for a year with Melbourne, and I was transferred over here, and it was a very uncomfortable transfer. It was difficult for the family. We'd left both our families behind, and it simply didn't work out. And I went back to Victoria, to country Victoria, where my family came from, and spent 12 months with my working in my stock and station business with my father, which he'd been there forever, and Coach Seymour in the Golden Valley, you may or may not be aware, but we won a premiership. And then from left field, got a call from West Torrens to see if I'd be interested in coaching over here. And so we took up the opportunity and came back to somewhere we didn't like in the first place, which is you'd say, "What the hell are you doing?" But and I've been here ever since. And so I coached West Torrens for 4 years, and I must highlight in an interview like this, I was actually a premiership coach. We won a night premiership, but then became deregistered. Does that sound better than sack? Paul Weston came back to West Torrens, and they asked me what I thought about that, and I said, "Well, why not? If we don't win a premiership next year, I won't be here anyway." But they took it a step further and brought the decision forward. So I wasn't coaching. And since then, I've spent a lot of time in admin. I was CEO at North Adelaide and Glenelg Football Clubs here twice, and had two stints. There's an ironic sidelight for you. I was at Glenelg the first time around when Mark Williams was told he wasn't required. So I wonder to this day if Mark Williams would have ended up an AFL premiership coach if Glenelg hadn't have told him he wasn't ready or they weren't happy with him. They'd brought in a Port Adelaide player and it didn't sit very comfortably at Glenelg. And I think from there, Mark went and may have coached reserves at Essendon with Kevin Sheedy. And his whole career blossomed from that. So he was probably very fortunate what happened at the time. But and I spent 4 years with Adelaide United, or 5 years with Adelaide United in the A-League, which was thriving at the time. And I believe it's not travelling as well now. But I had an offer to go there as CEO, and I told the owners, whom I knew very well, who took over the licence, that I said, no, my name ends in T, it does end in I or O. I'm not going to do this job. But anyway, it was a fabulous experience internationally to be involved in it. And, so I finished up with the Bays in 19 when we won the premiership and retired at their 1920 AGM. So that's is that a quick summary of all my South Australian involvements?
Lived in the fair bit this. Maybe there.
Live down the coast and do a lot of swimming in a place called Port Elliot, actually, at Horseshoe Bay. So it's a stunning, stunning venue.
And just quickly, you also had, just going back a little bit into your career, you had opportunity playing with both your brothers at one stage or another. They're at one St Kilda, one at Melbourne. It was a bit of a interesting crossover. You probably wouldn't get many players to get that sort of opportunity. How was that whole thing?
Well, it was an incredible day. Robert, it's sort of, I think I highlighted some of the financial problems that some of St Kilda's great stalwarts played their way through that. Robert probably wasn't one of them. And when I went to Melbourne, he came across, and then Bruce had a crack. And, yes, it would have been interesting to have played on it for they both played on for the next year. I think Robert had 2 years. Bruce may have had one. But it would have been interesting to have stayed at Melbourne and had the second year under Carl, and then Barassi came back, of course. But it was a really trying year for that footy club. And as we all know, you win or you lose. And you know, most sins in a football club are forgiven when you win, and when you lose, every single thing you've ever done wrong comes to haunt you. But that'd be a nice Trivial Pursuit question, wouldn't it, in the VFL, AFL, to name the three brothers that have all played together at the one club. And yeah, it was a fabulous achievement, and full credit to both Robert and Bruce. And I know it made my parents really proud at the time, and a lot of the A people came down, and they loved it.
And am I right in thinking that you won a reserves best and fairest as well?
it's the only way forward, isn't it? Before they take it seriously, yeah.
Well, that wasn't just sticking on the family theme, but that wasn't the only achievement from a reserves patch. Either, was it? Did you meet your significant other at a reserves game?
Yes, you've done a bit of research, haven't you? Well, I can tell you exactly what happened. I was a disgruntled reserves player, and the reserves was over, and Lois, my wife, was walking through the gates near the change rooms at Moorabbin with a girl called Dorothy Betts, and I was not about to go up and sit in the stand and act as if I was interested in the A grade. So I was on my way out and said good day to Doc. And she said, oh, a friend of mine, would you like to say hello? So we did. And that's how we met. And so we're still together after all these years, which is fantastic. Probably more credit to Lois than me. Yes, it was a very strange way to meet your future partner, wasn't it? To be he was paying to go in to watch St Kilda play, and I was sulking and going out.
Encapsulates the way that footy changed lives, yes, I think, in a really significant way.
Yeah, and I admire the due diligence you've shown in this interview. Because very few people in this world would know it.
Well, one player you've mentioned, last one from me, that not a lot of people would know about privately would be Carl Dittrich. He keeps a lot to himself. We know that he's a quiet character that sort of drifted off a bit after his football career. Can you tell us just a little bit about Carl? You mentioned the crossover with Melbourne as well. And what was Carl like as a bloke? I just get the feeling that if you were playing footy with him, you'd walk a little bit taller knowing that, you know, I've got a bit of protection, a bit of reinforcement out here with the big fella.
He was priceless for me, and we don't keep in touch every 5 minutes, but we do keep in touch and compare long-term injuries like ankle things like that and how you recover. And I've seen him up north a couple of times when we've got away from the cool weather here in Adelaide, and it would be in Victoria as well. But I think he was a player's player. That's probably the best way I can describe it. He wasn't known for being out, and maybe, I don't know, in that era, the premiership era, when he was probably footloose and fancy free, but when I met him, he was he's very supportive. He'll always take a phone call from you, which is great. We have extended conversations. I don't think I could keep up with him having a beer. He'd probably have me covered, I think. But at Melbourne it was infamous, and I know we can chat about a lot of things, but a fellow called Gary Sidebottom was playing for St Kilda at the time, and Trevor Barker, whom I knew quite well, and Barks came through, Pack and I sort of half grabbed him and had a bit of a laugh about it, and Sidebottom took offence and popped me on my backside pretty quickly, and I had one look at him and I wasn't going to get up very quickly because he was a bit bigger. Until a bloke called Dietrich came along and put him on his backside, and and I got up and gave Sidebottom a fair bit of advice then, and a few physical prods. But he made people walk tall. There's no question of that. And I think maybe one of you people will maybe all across it giving you a due diligence, but I think was it Alan Jeans or somebody describing him as an athlete who taught himself to play football? Because he could jump 6 foot at school, I think, and the Sunday morning training sessions we'd have at Moorabbin, it wouldn't matter what time he got home or what time he attended training, he would just pound lap after lap after lap out, and he might have inspired me a little bit too to make some compensation for some obvious deficiencies of, in my case, lack of pace. And just try and follow Dittrich doing 400s. I think everyone that you would speak to, and no doubt you've spoken to plenty, they would speak in glowing terms of him. And he's just a good fellow to catch up with.
Glenn, last one from me, but nearly 8 years ago, you were inducted into the St Kilda Football Club Hall of Fame. Now, not only were you inducted on the same night as Stuart Trott, who's also been on this show in the past, but you were inducted on the same night that Tony Lockett elevated Rob Harvey to legend status and gave his introduction. And it was also the 50th anniversary of the 66 Premiership. What did that night mean to you?
In footy terms, there's a lot of things you never forget. And I never forget the call from Ross Smith. He said, just called me out of the blue, actually, to say, would you be free on such and such a date? I've forgotten what it was. And I said, why, is there a club event on? He said, we'd probably like to award you in the Hall of Fame or present you with your Hall of Fame presentation. Well, there was stone cold silence from my end of the phone until Smithy said, are you still there? And it was the biggest surprise I've had in terms of recognition. It was just so greatly appreciated, and to go back there and see all the various people that you played with, and to be recognised by your peers, I think is just the most rewarding thing in sport. And the fact that they were so complimentary, and Cowboy actually interviewed me. Carl Dittrich was supposed to be interviewing me, but he arrived late. Or he had another function to get to, which I held him account for after it. But The cowboy took plenty of liberties in the questions he asked as well. So it was, suffice to say, it became a bit robust, the conversation.
So what's your, I guess, supportership of the club these days? Do you still keep close tabs on the team? Do you still watch most games? Do you ever get to many games? And if you do, what do you see with the current group? Do you see any players that sort of stick out to you, or what do you think about Ross Lyon? And where's your sort of level that you're at these days?
Well, so I can add to you, Chad, you mentioned Ross Lyons. I was with Adelaide United. We were playing in Perth. And you might remember when Ross left St Kilda, or was left from St Kilda. And we were down at Fremantle having a coffee. We weren't due to play because the soccer was always played over night time, or football, sorry. When I was involved in soccer, I had to call it football. And we were having a coffee, and Lois said, "Oh, that's Ross Lyons. And go and say g'day." And I said, "Lois, Ross Lyons wouldn't know me from a bar of soap." But taking instructions from my wife, I went across myself, and I said, "Ross, Glenn Elliott." And he said, "Yeah, no." He said, I know you're at the club." And I said, "What are you doing over here?" And he explained the unfortunate aspects of the financial problems that happened back then. And it was strange to see him. So I've always followed his coaching, which always seems to be honest, and it always seems to produce a competitive outcome, which is, and it was just fantastic to see him back at St Kilda. And I think his competitive influence kicked in straight away last year, and hopefully the club can take a step forward this year, which would be great. But in terms of connections, I've tried, if I've been back to Melbourne a couple of times to past player functions or events that are on, and picked up a mate of mine up at Alexandra who was a long-time supporter of the club with the social club side of it, and taken him down to a couple of shows. And we'll see them play over here in Gather Round. I called a couple of people in the sample today and said, "You owe me a favour. Can you help me out with a couple of tickets?" One wasn't too abiding, but the other one was. So that was. So we'll get to see them. And have any of you been to Gather Round?
Not yet.
Last year, we went to the last game. I've never heard of, the Saints played St Kilda, played Collingwood, I think it was.
Yep.
And I've never heard 40,000 people at Adelaide Oval so quiet. It was nearly polite clapping when St Kilda or Collingwood took a mark, because the stadium was full of people who were just there. They weren't necessarily Collingwood or St Kilda supporters. So it was like a practice match. So I hope that this year, I think we play, when I say
Richmond.
Play them at Norwood Oval. I think that both clubs will be putting some tape measures around their oval to shrink them a bit for training exercises, because not much room to move on Norwood Oval. It's not a big oval, and they'll probably get 10 or 12,000 people there, which will be probably like the old VFL days, actually.
As long as they get the result, that's the main thing. But Glenn, We appreciate you joining us. It's been great to reminisce and tell some stories. And, yeah, we wish you well with everything going forward, but thanks for jumping on this week.
Well, I hope I haven't crossed any lines. I've told most of the polite stories, not the mischievous ones.
We have had Russell Morris on, who's crossed that line well and truly. So.
Yeah, done it before.
Thanks, mate.
Pleasure. Thank you. Cheers. Thanks for the time, too.
Glenn Elliott was a star through the 70s and had a very good career in administration since. We take on the Bombers, Jade Gresham, against St Kilda. Essendon, scratchy in a win over Hawthorn. I actually thought they looked better in the loss to Sydney than they did in the win over Hawthorn, although a very open game. They've conceded 64 scoring shots in the first 2 weeks, including 28 against the Hawthorn side that's struggling to score. And had Hawthorn a kick straight, they would have won that game in the opening round, 11-17 to 17-5 or something of that nature. Peter Wright gets suspended. Obviously, we lose Max King, we lose Liam Henry, Mason Wood, the obvious one. Brad Crouch probably would have played this week, you think, in place of Wood, but he's out as well. So then you look at potential changes. Nick and Caminiti for King seems one obvious one. Butler for Henry seems another obvious one. The third one, not so obvious, but maybe it's a Garcia or a Collard, but perhaps a Garcia gets an opportunity to provide a bit of run this week.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think it's Caminiti for King, Garcia, and Butler. I think they're the three to come in. I mean, it seems simple. I think when you don't have that many that can come in, there's a bunch of guys that just aren't ready. You know, we hear a lot about Ari and kind of his game for Sandy, but I just watching some of that game and seeing him up close and personal in that North Melbourne practice match at Moorabbin, he's so far from ready that it's not funny. And there are a bunch of other kids, you know, Keeler and Heath and those guys. You know, Ollie Hotton's exciting. Hasn't played that much footy. So I think those three are the obvious ones really for this particular situation, given the outs and you know, given who we're playing, where we're playing, that they just seem to be the obvious ones.
Mm. Sort of looking at it going, after Essendon's rucks, which they seem to have 13 of, they're not a quick team when you take away a lot. Their midfielders aren't that quick. They use a lot of the ball. They get it. They're very much a have to kick to a good spot sort of team. I feel like they're a sort of team that we could use a lot of pace and get around. And you just look back at the practice game at Moorabbin, and that's what we did. We used our pace. We ran the ball, and it made it hard for them. They were chasing tail most of the day. It was a kind of a watching us pass them with ease. So I'm wondering, do we go in with a bit more run instead? Do we try to find, I guess, a mix that has these smaller, quicker running players and exploit that? We're still going to have Membry. We're going to have Cooper up front. We're going to have Marshall would drift back and drift up forward. And we're still going to have big targets there. Do we just bring in a little bit more speed and just run like hell that day? I think it could be a winning way to go. We saw Marshall see off two ruckmen on the weekend, so it's not like he can't do it. And yeah, if we're not winning the heat outs like we did on the weekend, just play to what they're doing. Marshall steps in as pretty well a fourth midfielder when you look at it. So it's possibly, yeah, a great idea to just go small against them and just run like the wind. So
well, that small ball, I mean, to borrow a basketball phrase, that small ball kind of game did work against them last year. I know it was at the G and all that sort of stuff, but yeah, I think we had Cordy and Caminiti up front, and it was Butler and Higgins that did all the damage. Really, the taller forward's job was just to bring the ball to ground at that stage, bring the ball to ground and let the smalls do the work. And so there is some method to that type of madness, I guess.
I mean, Cordy had, from memory, in that game last year, I think he had one possession, and Caminiti didn't score, or pretty sure he didn't score, maybe one goal early. But on the most part, I think he kicked one in the first 5 minutes, maybe. But we didn't get a lot out of those two guys in terms of scoreboard influence. Mitch Owens was lively across half four. We got Membry this time. And this is where I mentioned at the start that you trust the system. It's not ideal that you're missing a bit of pace and that you're missing Max King, who's a match winner. But if the system stands up, the one soldier down, one soldier up, you're almost at a tipping point with injuries, almost. You've got to stop the bleeding on that front and slowly get a couple back. Look, having Paddy Dow available, you know, a week or so later is going to be useful in terms of midfield reinforcements. Clark would be maybe three away. Dougal Howard not far off, Jack Hayes not far off. So you just got to hang in there, find a way to get a result here. You've got some tricky games ahead, but I think we're certainly capable. And, you know, it's good to have someone like Ross at the helm who will, you'd think, make the right decisions to set us up in the best possible way to give us every chance against an Essendon side that is dangerous. Clearly, they've got a lot of midfield options. I don't think they're sensational. I don't think they're necessarily better than the two sides we've played so far. But, you know, it's 50-50 or marginally our way and just find a way to get over the line.
Well, the situation that we go into this game is pretty similar to how we went in last year. I mean, the big difference now is that, you know, we're going in with a year's more experience into Owens and Filippo and Winhager and those guys. And you know, Darcy Wilson, who's come in, looks like a ready-made senior footballer. You know, so I think while the situation is similar, the baseline is further ahead of where we were same time last year. And we know what Ross was able to do from a coaching strategy performance perspective last year with the outs that we had, with the ins that we had, and the team that he had to trot out on the park each week for those first kind of, you know, 6 or 8 weeks or whatever it was, that he can make it work. The guy's just, I mean, he's a bit of a mad genius when it comes to that sort of thing, is that, you know, like you said, it's all about the team. And if the team buys in and if you're all on the same page and playing your role, then you can win regardless of the players that aren't out there, because the players who are there are all doing the things that they should be doing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You stare down the challenge and you see where it lands, and it'll be interesting playing them at Marvel and their home ground, or their home game, rather. Looking at some of our listener questions, I guess Mick asking the obvious one, any concerns around the progress of some of our injuries? Don't know about the progress, just more the severity of them, where it's been, you know, worst case scenario for most of them, and that's a lot of that's bad luck. You know, Liam Henry didn't even have the hamstring iced after the game on Thursday, and then it ends up being pretty severe. So whether that was mismanaged, I don't know.
The one that I've got an issue is the Crouch one. I mean, he was clearly not right. He hasn't been right for a while. If you watched him play over the last couple of weeks. And so you just wonder, what could the club have done? Like, if you as an outsider can watch him running around and see that the guy's not right, why is he out there? And why aren't they doing something about it? Like, why didn't they send him in for an arthroscope a month ago or 3 weeks ago or whatever, when it was clear that, you know, there's an issue with that knee? That's probably my biggest concern. The rest, you know, There's not a lot you can do about a knee. You know, Jack Hayes has not been on the park for a while, so it's different. Mason Wood, you know, contact injury and you know, concussion and that sort of stuff. A lot of these things are kind of, you know, collateral damage or contact stuff that no amount of training or whatever is going to change. But it's those things, the things that you can kind of see and visualize, you can see it happening almost in front of you. And you wonder, how does it get to the stage where all of a sudden, you know, a couple of days out from round three, we're sending guys for arthroscopes when it's been clear for weeks already that they're not right?
Yeah. And that's whether they were rushing it because they had too many others injured, I'm not so sure. Mm. But yeah, clearly an issue in, and, you know, that's come home to roost. And Bobba says, where to now for Crouch? Like, I think he's still got a role to play. But,
yeah,
we've just got to get him right. Tim.
He's been our best midfielder for the last couple of years.
Correct. That's right. And Tim says, looking at the 2019 list of 48 players, only 11 remain 5 seasons later. That's almost 80% gone. We've had a rebuild and the new place is looking fantastic. Do you think we can look at this period like the 06-07 period and we have the awesome roller coaster ride ahead? Yeah, looking at, you look at drafting and, you know, I was having a bit of a look at it. These are the guys that debuted for us 2010, 11, 12 through that period. So Nick Hayne played 3 games. Reece Stanley went to another club. good player, though. Tom Lynch, ditto. Luke Miles, who? Daniel Archer played one
game. Won a
grand
final sprint, Luke Miles, I reckon.
Yeah. Alistair Smith played three games. Jamie Cripps, good player, but left. Will Johnson played one game. Aaron Sipos, 24 games. Nicholas Winmar played two. Tom Ledger, 12. Tom Simpkin, 20. Then you had guys like Sam Dunnell in there, Nathan Wright, Tom Lee, Josh Saunders, Brody Murdoch, Jackson Ferguson, Tom Curran, Cam Shenton. They were our debutants. The only standout amongst all of that was Seb Ross and Jack Nunes, who played quite a bit of footy. So then you compare that to, you know, our recent debutants with Filippo, King, Windhager, Owens, Wanganeen Miller, Wilson, those sorts of players. And it just shows you what happens when you get that right. It's simple as that, really.
Yeah.
But,
I think the jab at Ross for not playing kids last time that he coached us. I mean, you go through that list and you sort of think, well, not many of them going to go, but did many of them pass the Ross Lyon test? That was probably where it came down to. Because if he doesn't like the way a player plays, they're not going to play. That's as simple as it is. He's seen things in these kids that we've got and gone, you are playing football. You are playing in this team and you're going to keep getting that opportunity until it's right. And I mean, we saw Mateus get a full season and he didn't do much wrong. That's for sure. I mean, he was still very wet behind the ears, but Ross said, you're going to play every game. You're going to get out there and show us what you can do. And that's just going to build the confidence and it's going to build the skill and it's going to build the him as part of the team. And he's done that multiple times with multiple players now when you look at it. So the young list that has been built by him in this one, as opposed to, I guess he could have tried it with the players that you listed off before. And chances are most of them wouldn't have got anywhere near what we've got right now. It's just a completely different list compared to what he had last time. We don't have that top level superstar or the superstars at that stage. It's a very much more even list, and it's probably a lot they're finding a lot easier to get into that team, hold their spot, but also blend into that team. They're not going to be just hidden away like I guess some of those other players were back then.
I love the odd pop culture reference and the movie The Club from the 1980. There's a scene in that which kind of reminds me of Ross Lyon maybe 10, 12 years ago where I think the president says to him, you wanted us to buy players, what's your problem? And he holds up that picture of Jeff Hayward saying, you're buying the wrong bloody ones. So I think that was probably the case then, that we were drafting the wrong kids and now we're drafting the right kids, so he'll pick them. So that's the difference at the end of the day. I mean, Jack Stephen and David Armitage got games back then. They were good pickups.
Yeah, Sam Gilbert, Ben McAvoy.
Yeah, correct. All debuting under him and went on to have a Jaron Geary debuted under Ross and played a lot of footy through that time as well.
All the Freo blokes, like half that Freo team.
Yeah,
Look at those guys. Brayshaw,
even like Adam Chera, who's not there anymore. Brayshaw, Caleb Sarong, maybe, unless he's too young, but he might have just tacked
too young.
On to
I think. Yeah,
too young. But yeah, there's certainly plenty through that period. I guess the final thought before we wrap things up, Nick, you had a question in regards, I think actually it's ironic because this week there's 1,000 examples of it, but you had a question around a segment that we do run.
I've got a couple of final thoughts, a bit of an argument, a bit of a blue on Twitter over the weekend, over the last couple of days with a listener who said he's had enough of that So St Kilda and it's pathetic loser mentality. And I guess wanted to raise it to the listening group. Are you sick of that So St Kilda? Do you like it? Do you hate it? Do you kind of see the ironic satire in it or do you think it is kind of loser mentality? So maybe we'll put a poll out to the listeners, but what do you guys think?
I understand the question. And look, I get it that you can have that defeatist mentality sometimes, and look, St Kilda maybe have been guilty of that a bit in the past, or definitely have been guilty of that in the past. But I think there's also, you know, there's that black humour where you can laugh at things that you just suspect will happen. It doesn't mean that, oh, we're fucked and we'll lose or anything like that. You just kind of laugh at it. And, you know, I'm in a group with a bunch of other Saints fans, and we made the observation that you're riding high on Thursday thinking, how good's footy? Love it. Fantastic. And something has to happen the next day to make you feel like shit. It's just the nature of it. It's like, oh, Liam Henry's out, Mason Wood's out. Oh, Max King got suspended for something no one even saw. It's kind of that perception that you have that, you know, there's always a down not far from an up, and there's always an up not far from a down. So I think if it's taken for what it is, we're not sitting there going, this is why we'll never succeed. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just taking the piss out of the, you know, the looming curse that just sits there in the background all the time.
It's a throwback to almost history when you look at it. It's like whenever something's possibly looked good, it's something's come along and changed that or – I don't think there'd be anything we've brought up in any of these that haven't been brought up by St Kilda fans in their own groups. And they're pretty much things that would have been discussed every minute up until we've actually talked about it on here. And it's, I guess you'd almost put it out, it's just common knowledge.
And the reality is that, you know, the Jam, by Friday evening, the Jam was squeezed out of the donut a little bit by some of that injury. And you're like, that shits me because it should be a good day today, and frustrated about that, thinking about matchups. And, you know, that's no one's fault, but it's annoying. And that is very much so St Kilda. So, yeah, look, I get the debate. I do. But, I think as long as people take it for what it is. I think what we just said there is so St Kilda that what happens – was that kind of poetry of the exact segment that we're talking about. That, you know, we're sitting here on a Tuesday night with fighting a Max King suspension that we didn't even know was going to happen. So, and it, and it makes a game that we were a very good chance of winning 50-50 probably. So, it's a reality and it is annoying.
It is annoying. I do have one more final thought. And we've talked a little bit about perspectives and perception and all those sorts of things. And one of those things is that one that you guys brought up before about that perception that Ross Lyon never played the kids. There's another Ross Lyon perception that's out there that is that he is this dour, defensive, hard-to-watch football coach. No one talks about the fact that he, you know, his St Kilda team led the league in scoring at least one year, was top three or top four a couple of other years during that kind of 2008 to 11 period. No one talks about the fact that Champion Data had us rated the number one ball movement team last year, despite having half a year of what felt like pretty average football. And if you haven't watched St Kilda play, if you still think after the first couple of weeks and after the preseason, if you still think that St Kilda's a boring team because Ross Lyon's a boring coach, you haven't watched St Kilda, because this team is fun to watch. They are fun to watch. They're offensive. They're hard. They're tough. Excuse me. They move the ball quickly. They kick it long. They run. They do all the things that fun, entertaining teams do. And I think if you're still referring to Ross Lyon as a dour, boring defensive coach, then you haven't watched his teams play for a while.
Yeah, and the two messages I got from neutrals on Thursday night, one was from a Carlton supporter and one was from a Melbourne supporter. And the Carlton supporter said, best transition team in the comp.
Mm-hmm.
And the Melbourne supporter said, far too quick for Collingwood tonight.
Yep.
So those two things don't ring true if you're boring.
Yeah. And
pointing from Champion Data's been saying it for 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And back in that too, I mean, what is the old saying that I guess most people bring up all the time, that premiership team starts from the back line. That's your defense is what's going to win your game. You're going to be the most attacking team in the world and give away more goals than what you kick. It's if you got no defense, you're not going to win a game anyway. He built that into the 9-10 teams, that defensive mindset, but we had the ability to score at the same time. It was then when the team dropped down, we still might have had that ability to defend, but we didn't have that ability to score. And that's the first thing that fell away, the ability to score. And that's where I guess that came from, that whole, oh, he's just a defensive coach. No, we just couldn't kick goals. It was basically our only issue.
And so, this week is where we see that example of maybe you do pull the handbrake and change things up and try to win that way because that's what the situation calls for. But
yeah, yeah, when you've got weeks where you go, yeah, you need to tag a few more players than normal or shut down someone or that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, as I was saying, you can run off. I mean, Essendon kicked 101 points last week and lose by 5 goals.
Exactly.
That's attacking football.
Whereas we'll never lose if we kick 101 because of the way we defend.
No.
Never. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's the reality of it. But fingers crossed we can, I won't say grind because that's a negative word, but will our way to a result on Saturday against Essendon. A happy Easter to all of the listeners, and hope you enjoy this podcast over the course of the week, the chat with Glenn Elliott and our chat that we posted during the week with Andrew Plimpton, the late president of the football club through the 90s. But enjoy the rest of the week wherever you happen to be, and go Saints.